This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 2nd of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Gillian Tobias and welcome to The Recap, bringing you highlights from this past week of live news and analysis programmes broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily, along with The Ten. Coming up...
It's the first state visit by a Japanese Prime Minister for 9 years, and although the Japanese-US relationship is always important, I think it's a particularly important visit at this point for both leaders.
We hear from former British ambassador to Japan, Sir David Warren, as Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe starts his week-long visit to the United States. Plus,
one could argue that the United States has overlearned the lessons of Vietnam. One of the principal ones is that the United States should not engage in military operations overseas without the overwhelming support and understanding of the American people.
As this week marks 40 years since the fall of Saigon, we ask what lessons have been learned since then. All that and much, much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Gillian Tobias. And let's start the show off with a highlight from The Globalist. Japan's foreign ministry has warned that without the continued influence of the US, China will dominate the Asia-Pacific region within 2 decades. The release of the report coincides with a week-long visit by the Japanese Prime Minister to the US. In it, Japan is urged to make positive approaches to the United States. In this highlight of Monday's edition of The Globalist, Monocle's Emma Nelson is joined by Sir David Warren, former British ambassador to Japan and associate fellow at Chatham House.
Well, this is a very important visit for both countries. It's the first state visit by a Japanese prime minister for 9 years. And although the Japanese-US relationship is always important, I think it's a particularly important visit at this point for both leaders. The Japanese prime minister, Abe Shinzo, is going to want President Obama to recommit himself to the strength of the US-Japanese alliance. He's going to want some guarantee of US support in the face of any aggression or hostility by China, which of course concerns the Japanese administration. He's going to want to recommit when he talks to both houses of Congress and the Senate on Wednesday to Japan continuing to be, as the former Prime Minister Nakasone described it, the unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Pacific, and that Japan is prepared to do its part to share the burden of US protection in the Asia-Pacific region. And he's going to want to advance the trade talks which are taking place in the context of the negotiations for the Free Trade Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which have made rather slow progress, but which both sides are going to want to push forward in some way.
That is a meaty shopping list. To what degree do you think the United States is either willing or indeed able to be responsive in all those areas?
Well, I think the United States will want to be responsive on the essential importance of the alliance. Japan is crucial for the US in terms of its providing the base for US forces in Northeast Asia. We have something like 37,000 US service personnel who are stationed in or around Japan, and Japan does play a crucial role in US's Asia-Pacific security profile. And the alliance is very important in terms of the US's geopolitical position in the Asia-Pacific, and it always has been since the Second World War, and particularly since the signing of the Security Alliance in 1960. So Japan's strategic role for the US as an ally and partner remains crucial. But of course, the unspoken issue here is the rise of China, which the Japanese feel is both a threat to their position, but also, of course, China is their most important trade and investment partner. And so they're conflicted. They know that they need positive relationship with China. They know that China represents a potential threat to their position until recently of preeminence in economic and political terms in the region. They want the US to protect them against the possible threat to the status quo from China's rise, while recognising that the US wants a close relationship with China too.
We saw both Shinzo Abe and Xi Jinping shaking hands last week in a much more comfortable manner than they did a little while ago. So there's obviously, on the face of it, a positive effort on both sides to, at least when it comes to economic ties, to improve. But when it comes to the way that Japan then takes that to America, and the fact that there are these defence guidelines which bind the countries so strongly together, there have been calls for a revision to these defence guidelines in terms of missile defence, minesweeping, ship inspections. To what degree do you think Abe will be able to successfully reposition Japan militarily in the way that many think that he wishes to?
Well, I think there are two separate issues there. There's the defence and security relationship, as you rightly say, which is crucial, and where I think that Abe and Obama will want to announce further measures of defence cooperation. And that's in the context of an alliance between the two countries. Then there's what Prime Minister Abe wants to do by way of adjusting the Japanese constitution so as to allow Japan to play a more supportive role in terms of what's called collective self-defence. And that means helping, coming to the assistance of its allies, i.e. America, in the case of Japanese nationals or Japanese territory being threatened. And that's controversial within Japan, because Japan is still a pacifist country, and a lot of people in Japan feel uncomfortable about Japan playing a more overt role, even in terms of collective self-defense. This isn't about, I think, Japanese aggression. It's simply about Japan becoming a more normal country, as they say, in defense terms, and playing a greater role in the world in this area. Then there's the relationship between China and Japan, which we've had two meetings now between Abe and Xi Jinping. The first one last year in Beijing, pretty chilly, but at least they met. Last week in Jakarta, they met again, and the mood music appears to be a little bit more forward-looking in terms of talking about how to get better lines of communication, how to work for a better relationship. And what we're told is that both sides really want to make this work. But there are some fundamental tensions between the two countries, which neither leader is going to want to brush over. So we're looking at a marginally improving relationship, and it's encouraging that I won't call it warmth, but an element of diplomatic correctness and positive thinking is creeping in.
That was former British ambassador to Japan, Sir David Warren, speaking to Monocle's Emma Nelson on Monday's The Globalist. You're listening to the recap on Monocle 24. Now, this week was marked by violent riots in the US city of Baltimore. On Tuesday, thousands of troops and police officers were drafted into the city as President Obama blamed criminals and thugs for the violence. Hundreds of people started fires, looted shops, and confronted police across the city. 15 buildings were destroyed, and more than 100 cars set on fire. Schools and businesses were amongst those affected by a week-long curfew announced after trouble erupted over the death of a black man, Freddie Gray, fatally injured in police custody. In this highlight from the Monocle Daily on Tuesday, Andrew Muller and Paul Osborne were joined by Professor Dee Watkins from Coppin State University, who's been writing on the situation in the city. But before that, they also spoke to David Usborne, the US editor for the Independent newspaper, who joined them live from Baltimore.
Professor Dee Watkins from Coppin State University, a writer who's written several times on the situation in Baltimore. You wrote in one piece that I read a little earlier that, you know, for your generation, police officers have been the most consistent terrorists in our neighborhoods. That's a statement that a lot of people would find a bit shocking.
Well, it's not really shocking. Baltimore is a super segregated city. The whites are really separated from the blacks. There's a few places where black and white people and, you know, a lot of different diverse groups cross. But for the most part, for the black neighborhoods, especially like the ones in East Baltimore that I grew up in, police enforce. In the white neighborhoods, they protect and serve. So, you know, we've been going back and forth and having problems with the police officers for years. Most of them don't live in Baltimore. They come in our neighborhoods, they beat us down, and they make up lies in their police reports to say that they were doing what they were supposed to be doing when they're not. And there's been always been an issue. So a lot of people think that this whole riot, and, you know, I can't even call it a riot because it's more of an uprise, is going on because of Freddie Gray. He's just like the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, once they did this to us, we just couldn't take it anymore. And a lot of young people got tired of listening to a lot of the older people, you know, and their leadership. and, you know, and watching the peaceful protests that don't really work. So that's where the anger and the energy came from. I'm right here, right where they burned the building down last night. It's like a whole 300 people out here, so I'm trying to get away. I'm sorry. I'm here.
You're quite right to describe Baltimore as a segregated city still. Many American cities still are to a degree, which I know always startles me whenever I go there. But Baltimore, it's not Ferguson, Missouri, which is an obvious point of comparison and where people did note the massive disparity in the makeup of the population and the makeup of the police. A huge proportion of Baltimore's police department is black. The police commissioner, Anthony Batts, is black. So is the mayor, Stephanie Rawlings Blake. Why has that not made a difference to the segregation that you describe?
Because real change doesn't really come from having a black person in office. We're dealing with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of systemic racism. We have a system in place that treats black lives like a commodity. And it's been going on for a long time before we had an opportunity to have these black people in power. And now that we have them, they're not really interested in making harsh changes and doing things that try to make it better. They're doing the same old things that have been done for years, as you can see. This investigation has been going on for longer than a week and something that should have been an open and shut case.
You called what had happened last night an uprising a little earlier. The mayor called the rioters thugs, and President Obama said they're not protesting, they're not making a statement, they're stealing.
Yeah, you know, and it's a sad situation because when students at some of these PWI, predominantly white institutions, get mad when their favorite basketball team loses and they flip over cars and set things on fire and kick the doors of stores in, they're just called vandals. But when black people get mad at the grossly unjust murder of one of their own, then we become thugs and horrible people. It's the same old thing. It's systemic racism and white supremacy that they hide with like loaded rhetoric. But you know, these people aren't thugs. They hurt kids. You know, you had an innocent man murdered, and these cops, it's looking like they might win.
There's no doubt, I don't think anybody's sane doubts that systemic racism is still an issue in the United States and indeed almost everywhere else. But is this response to it actually in any way justifiable? Is it actually helpful? Or I guess what I'm asking, is it possible to tell how many of the demonstrators are actually demonstrating and how many of them are just taking the opportunity to break things and steal stuff?
Okay, so let's not let mainstream media spin this out of control. There have been dozens of peaceful protests all over the city. I've been to many of them myself. The first act of violence really came Saturday night after we marched down City Hall, because from City Hall, we walked to Camden Yards where the Orioles play, a Major League Baseball team, and a lot of white people at the game started chanting, "We don't care, we don't care." And then some of them started calling, you know, some of the peaceful protesters apes and monkeys and the N-word, and that's when the violence started. The next day, everyone got so caught up from the emotions and what was going on at the funeral that it caused a whole lot of young people to just flip out. So I don't think, you know, I never think violence is the key. I will always rather things be handled in a peaceful manner, but the cops aren't handling things in a peaceful manner. There's scores and scores and scores and thousands of black people in Baltimore City that work, and we pay them out of our tax dollars. And in turn, they come into our communities and they beat us down and they harass us, and they don't give us the service that we deserve. So why should we always have to play fair if they never played fair?
Let's try and move this forward. If there isn't a repeat of that violence this evening, and there are a lot more police and troops on the ground tonight to try and stop that from happening, what do you think needs to change to try and improve the situation on the ground in Baltimore?
It's very, very easy. All the mayor has to do and all the commissioner has to do is call a press conference and say that they're going to charge the guy who did this to Freddie Gray, and all of it will go away. We just went tested. We're sick of begging for it. We're sick of singing for it. We're sick of marching for it. You know, they need to do what's right. The open and shut case, he was fine. He was okay. Police chased him, grabbed him, took him into custody, and then he died a few days later because of what happened to him. So, you know, if they wanted to change, then they need to just do the right thing.
That was a highlight from Tuesday's edition of the Monocle Daily on the escalating violence in Baltimore. On Wednesday, the world's longest-serving foreign minister was ousted after Saudi Arabia's King Salman gave his cabinet a reshuffle, also installing a new heir to the throne. The king's nephew and former head of a crackdown force on al-Qaeda now takes over as crown prince, the first time a grandson of the country's founder has become heir instead of a son. To discuss this, Monocle's Steve Bloomfield was joined by Ivor Gaber and Tim Marshall.
Forgive my cynicism. I'm desperately looking to be cheerful and say everything's going to be all right. It probably will all be all right, but I'm afraid it's, I think, and Ivor hopefully will disagree with me, it's a bit of window dressing. The Crown Prince is only 56. The guy that's been appointed.
Only 56.
What? Are you, he's a spring chicken.
That's young for a Saudi.
Exactly. But I remember him when he was the Interior Minister, and he was one tough cookie. He is a hardliner. He has got very good relationship with the Wahhabis. Basically, Saudi Arabia is run by two pillars of the establishment. One is the Wahhabi religious establishment, the other is the Saudi family, so they thought they'd call the country after themselves. It's like calling Timland or something, Marshall Land. They're called Saudi
Arabia. You're thinking of it, aren't you?
Well, yeah. give me time. Sorry, but the point being that they have jumped a generation, so at least when this octogenarian dies, they're not scrubbing around trying to find another 8-year-old to take over. They've got a 55-year-old there being groomed to take over when he's in his 60s or something. But that does not mean that they are heading a pace towards reform, because he is a very tough cookie and he is a religious man, and I don't believe he is the man who's going to open massive reforms. Hopefully there'll be some reforms.
Ivor Gaber, how hopeful are you that there are going to be some reforms?
Well, I'll play the part that Tim has assigned to me. I'm one of life's optimists. I do think it's quite important to jump generations, even if the new incumbent is a hardliner. It does give a different outlook. I mean, we've been dealing... the previous king was in his 90s, when nobody's quite sure how old. Your world outlook must be different. The new generation, and some of the new office holders are in their 30s, which is young, even, Steve, by your standards.
Thank you.
Must bring a different outlook. Now, I temper my remarks when I think back, when I was thinking of the octogenarians in power in Tehran, and when they had a younger man, Ahmadinejad, it wasn't exactly a breakthrough in terms of progressive
that's
politics.
That's partly my point. And the other point is that even if he did want to, let's say he wanted to give women driving licenses.
Oh, that's outrageously radical.
He might want to, but what about the Wahhabi establishment? If the Wahhabi religious establishment say we're not having that, he'll be out. Well, there'll be somebody else. And so it'll be incredibly slow reform.
Well, the bad news on that front is Saudi Arabia's only woman minister, in fact, she was a deputy minister, has been sacked. She was deputy minister of education, did see through certain reforms, but when she came out with the outlandish idea of letting Saudi schoolgirls do physical education,
outrageous,
that was just pushing it too far. So regrettably, although I seek to disagree with you, the straws in the wind are not all blowing in the positive direction.
Tim, you mentioned two groups that essentially are quite important for Saudi Arabia, the royal family and the Wahhabis. But there's also arguably another constituency which we should talk about, which is Western nations and Western companies that work in Saudi Arabia, be they oil companies, be they wonderful arms industries here in Britain and in America and elsewhere. And it's interesting, when you talk to those people, they're not that keen on reform in Saudi Arabia either, are they? Because they quite like the fact that it's, you know, in inverted commas, stable.
I knew you were going to say stable.
They love stability. Yes, they love a bit of stability.
It's the bottom line. I remember going over a few times when there was a bombing campaign to try and get the Westerners out. It was a very, very smart tactic by al-Qaeda about 10 years ago. They were bombing the compounds where the Western workers, and we got hold of some figures that suggested at least 30% of the Western workers actually did flee. Now, these were very sensitive numbers, because there comes a certain point, if enough Westerners can be forced to run away, when the oil industry can no longer function properly. And at that point, Saudi Arabia collapses, and that's what they want, to collapse it in order to take it over. And they were on their way, and it was a very smart move, and it was actually this Interior Ministry, who's now the Crown Prince, who actually took them on and actually dismantled them to a great extent. It made his career. So that's why they want stability. It's why the Wahhabis want stability. It's why the Sauds want stability. And it's actually why there is a significant proportion of the population that doesn't really want that much of a reform, because they're worried about what comes next. And that includes the 30% of the country who are Shia. If you start taking that lid off, I'm not saying you shouldn't, but if you take that lid off, look what's happening across their borders.
So why has the Saudis upped the ante in terms of the Sunni-Shiite dispute by intervening in Yemen, raising the rhetoric against
Iran? For precisely
Iran?
That reason, because they fear it. Because I know that they're playing with fire.
Yes, makes for instability.
Oh, they are playing with fire, but no, they want to make sure that the side that they want to win wins in Yemen, and the side that Iran wants to win does not win in Yemen. And that's why they've gone for it at the risk of instability, but they're trying to make sure it doesn't come across to their borders.
That was a highlight from Wednesday's edition of Midori House with Steve Blumfield. Up next, it's the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the programme as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the programme that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted here at Monocle 24. And I'm Gillian DeBias. Thursday marked 40 years since President Duong Van Min of South Korea, who had been head of the collapsing state barely 72 hours, announced its unconditional surrender to its rivals from the country's north. Hours earlier, South Vietnam's sponsor, the United States, had fled Saigon, which had just been renamed Ho Chi Minh City amid scenes unbecoming to a superpower. For four decades, America has struggled with the legacy of its defeat and humiliation in Indochina, a war in which nearly 60,000 Americans were killed, along with millions of Vietnamese, Laotians and Cambodians, to little discernible good. But what lessons did the US learn, and were they the right ones? To shed some light on this, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson were joined by Alan Hendrickson, Professor of Diplomatic History at Tufts University, and also Mark Moyer, author of Triumph Forsaken, The Vietnam War, 1954 to 1965, in this highlight from the Monocle Daily.
If I may start with you, Alan, much of the assessment in at least the media today has been that America has not just not learned the lessons from Vietnam, but has actively repeated them. Would you agree?
One could argue that the United States has overlearned the lessons of Vietnam. I mean, one of the principal ones that has really settled in is that the United States should not engage in military operations overseas, large-scale ones, without the overwhelming support and understanding of the American people. So that internal lesson is one which, more and more, is one which is realized and commented on. Of course, another is that one must understand foreign cultures much better than the U.S. ever understood Indochina more broadly. There's that cultural lesson. And then concern about communism has, you know, very considerably waned since the Cold War was over. The U.S. is dealing with, obviously, the People's Republic of China, which is a communist system. And even North Vietnam has become a friend and trading partner of the U.S. now.
Mark, I want to bring you in at this point. Does Vietnam, I guess, to people of your generation, and you were born in the early 70s as the Vietnam War was sort of drawing to a close, does Vietnam seem still like a big deal in the United States, especially after Afghanistan and very especially after Iraq?
Yeah, it's not as big a deal, I would say, but it's still, for those who are interested in foreign policy, I think it certainly is a matter of great interest. And President Obama was a little bit too young to have lived through Vietnam. But if you look at how his presidency has come along, he's certainly been influenced to a great extent by the so-called lessons of Vietnam. And, you know, Vietnam really split the United States between left and right in terms of foreign policy. And I think that's continued. And you see President Obama accepting the more liberal lessons of Vietnam and dangers of foreign involvement, for example. And the American right has very different views of what the lessons of Vietnam were, and that we were not tough enough, didn't use necessary military power in the correct way. And so I certainly see what has been going on in Iraq and Afghanistan has been influenced by what President Obama thinks the lessons of Vietnam are.
Mark, just to bring you up on that point ever so slightly, you're talking about Obama having learned the lessons of Vietnam when it comes to Iraq. We saw last year the United States desperately trying to help the Iraqi military, but failing to get the support of the local Sunni population to take on ISIS, when the Iraqi army effectively ran away from Islamic State militants. You get this impression that there is an American presence which is propping up, supporting an administration which would crumble were it not for American money, something which absolutely seemed to be the case in South Vietnam.
Well, in Vietnam, you had over a half million American troops, and I think that is the sort of involvement that President Obama has been reluctant to make in any place. Now, he did engage in Afghanistan early on, but he made a conscious effort to try to get out quickly. Now, Iraq, we saw the president wanted to get the U.S. out entirely, but then the events have required the United States to get back in, but he's been very intent on keeping that U.S. presence small. We've seen the same thing in Yemen where, and also in Libya, where the president's been extremely reluctant to commit American forces. And so there certainly are some parallels, but I think certainly the lesson of Vietnam for Obama is to try to minimize that U.S. military commitment to the greatest extent possible without, you know, complete world disorder.
Alan Henriksen, to bring you back in, you were outlining earlier there some of what are generally perceived to have been the lessons learned from Vietnam, and these were, of course, codified to an extent in the so-called Powell Doctrine, named for General Colin Powell before Gulf War I, and that insisted on things like clear objectives, overwhelming force, an exit strategy, an obvious national security interest to the United States. Now, that was adhered to pretty much in Gulf War I. Why was it kind of forgotten about for Afghanistan and Iraq? Was it just that the great trauma of September 11th reset America's worldview, or did people just forget?
I think that there was a recognition that these conflicts were different. In the first Gulf War, the objective was really a limited one, which was to liberate Kuwait, and that was doable fairly quickly. And as you'll recall, there was an enormous buildup, you know, Operation Desert Shield, which went on for weeks and weeks in Saudi Arabia. Overwhelming force was accumulated, and then when that was activated with Operation Desert Storm, you know, within about 100 hours, it was possible to liberate that country, but not to go beyond. I think there was a recognition even then that to move north would have been something like moving into North Korea during the Korean War. And one of President Bush's advisors was General Scowcroft, you know, who was someone who had been involved in policymaking during that period. Afghanistan, with a very difficult terrain, it's not obviously a jungle like Vietnam, but I think there was a recognition that that was not an operation that could have been done quickly, except perhaps to have gone in very early and decisively and specifically into Tora Bora to try to get, you know, Osama bin Laden. But the purposes were somewhat broadened, and then the emphasis was shifted wrongly to Iraq.
That was a highlight from the Monocle Daily on the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode of The Recap. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and edited by Claire Urban. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programmes here on Monocle 24. But now for me, Gillian Tobias, thank you for listening and goodbye.